I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today. News, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Richard Kreitner, author of the new book, Fear No Pharaoh, American Jews, the Civil War, and the Fight to End Slavery. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Got comments? Please email them to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. We celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's 77th Independence Day, last week, and it was a bit of a muted holiday, to be honest. First, because of the fact that Israel remains at war in Gaza, as well as in a larger war against Iran and its proxy enemies in Yemen, the Houthis, and the greatly diminished but still dangerous Hezbollah terrorists. Second, Yom HaAtzmaut was a little, well, less than usual because of the fact that 59 hostages remain in captivity in Gaza, held by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas, who kidnapped them and stole them from their lives. And the current estimate is that 25 or so of those hostages remain alive after over 18 months of brutal captivity to the Palestinians. Third, on Yom HaAtzmaut, there were wildfires all around Jerusalem that injured people, although, thank God, so far as we know, nobody died. Those impacted the celebrations of what is typically a major day of joy for Israel. Now, those considerations, as serious as they are, should not diminish our appreciation of the miracle of Israel's existence and resilience. It is important to remember that until the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, which came about through a vote of the United Nations, Jews had no guaranteed place of refuge when things went bad in the different countries we lived in. That included the United States, by the way. Jewish immigration to America was huge in the period between 1880 and 1920 or so, when troubles began in earnest in Germany and all over Europe in the 1930s, the United States was in one of its isolationist periods and very anti-immigration. That should sound familiar, no? So just when Hitler was fomenting the worst anti-Semitic pogroms in all history, which eventually turned into the Holocaust of European Jewry, Jews fleeing the Nazis had nowhere to go. Had Israel existed in the 1930s, the fascist perpetrators of the Shoah would not have been able to murder 6 million Jews, 2 million of them children. So at least the very existence of a Jewish state that accepts immigrants, if they are even a quarter Jewish, without exception, is a gigantic change for our people and for the world. In the years following the founding of Israel in 1948, after the victory in the hard-fought War of Independence against many much larger Arab armies, Israel accepted and absorbed more immigrants than it had citizens initially, by a factor of at least 2 and probably 3. That is, the 800,000 original Israelis, about 650,000 or so were Jewish, the rest predominantly Muslim and Christian Arabs. Those 800,000 original Israelis saw refugees fleeing persecution, primarily Arab countries, flood into Israel to the tune of, oh, maybe as many as 2 million. Initially, they were the displaced Jews of Europe, Holocaust survivors that the Allies had herded into camps in places like Cyprus and even in Germany. Then, refugees came from Egypt and Morocco and Yemen and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and Libya and Tunisia and Algeria and Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, places where Jews had lived for many, many centuries, but now were forced out and typically robbed of any wealth they possessed by the governments of the countries they fled, arriving in Israel with little but their clothes and their Zionist dreams of 1,800 years. Soon, even more refugees came to Israel, escaping Hungary and other Iron Curtain countries under the Soviet Union's iron rule, before the Russian control choked off immigration to Israel for decades. Somehow or other, the nascent Jewish nation, which was economically and natural resource poor and had to dedicate a great deal of its limited budget to defending itself and developing infrastructure, still managed to integrate and include all the new arrivals into the growing nation, seeing them as positive resources and additions to the country, which they certainly proved to be. It was an amazing feat. Today, we unfortunately take it for granted. You know, as we said on Passover, if that was all Israel accomplished by its existence, Dayenu, it would have been enough. But of course, that is far from all that Israel has accomplished. By the way, if the many Arab countries surrounding Israel had done nearly as much, or frankly anything, for the 200,000 or 300,000 or so Arab refugees of the War of Independence, they would have long ago been fully successful and integrated in the many Arab nations of the Middle East. The existence of the Palestinian problem is the direct manufactured result of the conscious choices of many Arab leaders to keep those particular Arab refugees in poverty and misery, so that they could be used against Israel. Tragically, it often resulted in terrible results, not only for those refugees themselves, but for the countries that kept the Arab refugees in camps. Jordan and Lebanon were convulsed by civil wars initiated by the now Palestinian Arabs. Lebanon has never fully recovered. As we said, Israel has done so much more than just be a refuge for the dispossessed Jews of the world. It has created amazing modern cities, excavated and displayed its fantastic archaeological heritage, pioneered desert agriculture and water use, become an international center of high-tech and medical technological development. Israel is a diverse, dynamic, exciting, creative, fun, serious nation worthy of wonderful celebrations any and every Yom HaAtzmaut, no matter the current conditions, which always vary. After all, this is by far the most advanced country in one of the most challenging regions of the world, the Middle East, and certainly the only democracy. May it continue to thrive and flourish. To play a sin this morning here on Too Jewish, this is an Israeli pop hit of this year, Peer Tassi's Ma Yihye Machar. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? You can say that at any time over Israel's 77-year history, but certainly now. But we know, no matter what, Israel will continue to develop and flourish. Am Yisrael Chai.
לא לפחד, פשוט לקפוץ אל המים ולשמור חבר אחד קרוב ואיפה שתלכי אקרא לזה בית אז אני גר כמעט בכל רחוב לא לנסות סתם להסתיר געגוע זה יאכל אותנו מבפנים דקה דקה ואז שבוע שבוע זה מגיע כשלא מחכים
That was Peer Tassi and his song Ma Yihye Machar. I'll take all the air into my lungs and hug you because who knows what may happen tomorrow. Good song. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Richard Kreitner, author of the new book Fear No Pharaoh, American Jews, the Civil War, and the Fight to End Slavery. find out just how important or insignificant slavery was to pre-Civil War and Civil War Jews, both North and South, and what new information emerged from this excellent scholar's work. Meet him when we return in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Richard Kreitner is the author of the new book, Fear No Pharaoh, American Jews, the Civil War, and the Fight to End Slavery. He's also the author of Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, and booked A Traveler's Guide to Literary Locations Around the World. He's an author who lives in New York. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so tell us why this book now.
Well, I've been working on it for about 15 years. It happens to be coming out now, and certainly I think its themes are resonant in the present. But, you know, I think there's really never a moment where they've not been. That began as an undergraduate paper that I wrote actually in college all those many years ago, where I was taking a year-long course in American Jewish history, and it just captured my attention. What happens when one people defined by an ancient experience of slavery finds refuge in a country defined by an ongoing experience of slavery? What choices do they make? What dilemmas do they face? And what costs are borne by those choices?
You know, you make a really fascinating point. We tend to think about, oh, okay, the exodus from Egypt is such a central aspect of Jewish identity. It's part of liturgy. Obviously, Passover, perhaps the most observed Jewish holiday of all. But the Jewish response to the concept of slavery when there were abolitionist Jews, and there were some, of course, came really out of the experience of Jews being oppressed in Europe, not so much out of this ancient memory. Tell us about that a little bit.
Sure, that's right. I mean, you know, they didn't need to go back all the way to Egypt to think about Jews being persecuted and oppressed, and even in their minds, enslaved in a certain way. You know, right, the Inquisition was also there. You know, the first Jewish people who got involved in the Atlantic slave trade, of which there were some, though not nearly as many as some anti-Semites have claimed, but they were themselves victims of the Inquisition, you know, who were fleeing this imposition of real terror in Spain and in Portugal. And then later on in the 19th century, Jews who were fleeing Europe, you know, especially people who had been involved in the revolutions of 1848, which tried to liberalize Europe but ultimately failed, they fled to the United States, and many of them came with their, you know, these ideals disappointed, but intact, and looked in America for some kind of cause worthy of their, you know, energies, and found it in this struggle over slavery.
I have sort of in the interest of full disclosure, I had three relatives who were involved in the Union cause. Two went missing, Del Bunco's, who had been from a family that was originally expelled from Portugal in 1496 or so. And then one who was one of the first Jewish chaplains who conducted high holiday services in occupied Vicksburg in 1864 and died when the steamboat blew up. So
I'm jealous. My ancestors came in 1905.
Most of mine did too, mind you. There's one kind of... There were Jews definitely on both sides in the Civil War, but not a very large number, right?
No, there were about 50,000 Jews in the United States in 1850, and then that number rises very dramatically to 150,000 by 1860, right about when the war breaks out, which is still obviously very, very small compared to today's numbers. And about four-fifths of them were in the North, and about one-fifth were in the South.
And that contributed to some of the so-called German units in the Army of the Potomac, for example, or in the West as well, right?
Yeah, there are a few units where Jews are disproportionately represented. I think far fewer than has been presented in earlier accounts of the American Jewish experience of the Civil War, some of which have kind of inflated those numbers. And there's a lot of scholars, who are taking another, more sober look at such accounts and such stories today, and showing that there were some, regiments that had a disproportionate Jewish presence in both the North and the South. But they were not, all Jewish units by any means.
No. We will talk much more with Richard Kreitner. His book, Fear No Pharaoh, is just out recently, about the Jewish involvement in the slavery and anti-slavery movements. It's a fascinating book, and we will be back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson, the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established 6.5 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning every week, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or join us on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. Religious School is signing up kids now for the 5786 school year that starts in August. Good for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Barn Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tykes Experience, Confirmation, and Teen programs, entering their seventh year, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, class, and events are open to everybody. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning services are at 10 a.m., preceded at 9 a.m. with Torah study, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Or you can come on our Facebook page for services, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services are all available in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. Access those by emailing us at rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org or go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha or to come to Downtown Shabbat, Friday night, May 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the Jewish History Museum, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tykes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years.
We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we've been talking about the far-flung and fascinating Jewish communities of the world. We got as far east as Iraq and Iran, but that's not the end of Jewish settlement, isn't it? There have been Jewish communities in places like Afghanistan and India and so on. I don't even know if we talked about the Bukharan Jews, sort of the so-called Silk Road Jews, but let's look at some of those communities.
Okay, with pleasure. Let's start with Afghanistan because, first of all, it borders Iran, which is the last country we talked about. And second of all, I have a great memory, an anecdote of the time I stayed there and I brought a gift from two sons in Jerusalem to their parents in Kabul. This was in the early 70s.
Wow.
And there was still a sizable Jewish community in Kabul, not huge, but you know, a few thousand anyway. And there was a daily minyan, which I went to with the father of these two young men who I knew in Jerusalem. I saw a daily minyan in a whole different light because it was a place where these guys would meet every morning and exchange news of what happened overnight. And then they'd meet again at the end of the business day for Mincha Maariv to talk about market trends and exchange rates and black market and whatever. And it served this incredible, like, community cohesion function that I had never seen a minyan serve before. These people also very kindly invited me to their home for Shabbat. And what was nice to see was that inside their home, they were much less exotic and foreign-seeming than they were on the street. In other words, women who on the street might wear a burqa, at home wore Western clothes. They shed the burqa and they looked completely like European lady.
Huh.
And this also is an ancient community. You refer to the Silk Route, that's part of it, all across Central Asia, which became part of the Soviet, well, part of the Tsarist Empire first, and then part of the Soviet Empire. There were communities established centuries ago to support the trade along this route. So from there grew Jewish communities in Samarkand and Bukhara and others. There's a widespread notion in America, I'm not quite sure where it comes from, that there's a Bukharan Jewish culture and language, which is also a little bit of an oversimplification because Jews in other parts of Uzbekistan, like Samarkand, have exactly the same cultures and customs and food. So if anything, it may be like Uzbek Jewry rather than Bukharan Jewry. But okay, we'll give the pro-Bukharans their due.
Okay.
And then if you go due south, you come to the most populous country in the world, which is India. And India has dozens of different Jewish communities. Not surprising, it has probably more different types of Jewish communities than any country in the world, in part because it has more people than any other country in the world. And those communities have different origins, different histories. A couple of them are tied to the old Portuguese Empire when Portugal had a number of outposts on the southwest coast of India. Jews who were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula a lot of Portuguese speakers went to Portuguese colonies in the then still infantile, youthful, let's say, not infantile, youthful Portuguese Empire. That's like Goa and those places.
Right, of course. Sure.
And then there are the Bnei Israel, and there's this and that, and in the far northeast of India, where nobody can visit without special permits, there are exotic Jewish communities that trace their roots to
the first temple, like the Bnei Menashe, those guys. Yep.
Exactly correct.
Tom, thanks. I feel like we could keep exploring other ones along the way, but we'll save it for another time. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rabbi Rabinowitz is traveling to Israel. He arrives at the airport and goes to check in his luggage. "Has anyone put anything in your baggage without your knowledge?" asks the TSA officer. Rabbi Rabinowitz answers, "Listen, if it was without my knowledge, how should I know?" You know, I tried that line once when going through security. They did release me, eventually. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Achrei Mod and Kedoshim, which includes the Holiness Code, a description of the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. The code itself includes mitzvot, requiring us to assist the poor, to treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness, and it insists on fair business practices. It obligates us to live moral lives. It's important this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kedoshim, the Holiness Code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of the heart of our most sacred text. And at that heart is the ethical injunction, Ve'ahavta l're'acha kamocha, love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is an amazing, perhaps utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If our society were really rooted in such a concept, how much better it would be for everybody. In a world in which violent wars tear apart nations like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, in which desperate refugees from famine and evil in places like Sudan are turned aside from many rich nations, where terrorist attacks can strike anywhere at any time, the idea of loving one's neighbor as oneself may seem particularly visionary. How can we believe in such a concept in a world in which horrible human violence can destroy anything? Can this utopian ideal of love for everyone possibly be made real? In true Jewish fashion, Kedoshim does not treat this as simply an idealistic idea. It is instead made into a practical imperative. Achrei Mod Kedoshim builds up to the religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and the stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and the orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures in your work. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical, because that lies at the heart of holiness. The way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her both fairly and honestly. It is that notion of the pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert neighbors to our own views of things. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of ourselves. Rather, we're commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, compassionately, generously. That is love of one's neighbor. as expressed in a functional, healthy society, or a synagogue or a Jewish community. May we all be able to live to this great ideal in the small, practical, honest ways that really matter. When we return in a moment, our guest, Richard Kreitner, explores the truths and myths about Jews in the antebellum South, about Jewish slaveholders and Jewish abolitionists, and just what history teaches us at a time when propaganda, including anti-Semitic propaganda, is everywhere. Find out the real truth.
We continue with our Two Jewish Updates on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Harvard University's president apologized for the campus climate over the last year and a half in a letter that accompanied a long-awaited report from a university task force at Harvard on anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias. The task force found that Jewish and Israeli students at Harvard experienced pervasive shunning and were relentlessly targeted for their identities by both peers and faculty in the days and months after Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, according to the report. It was released last Tuesday. "I'm sorry for the moments we failed to meet the high expectations we rightfully set for our community," wrote President Alan Garber, who convened the task force. He continued, "Harvard cannot and will not abide bigotry." The 311-page report comes 16 months after the committee first formed and days after the Trump administration publicly called for its release. The school published a parallel report, too, authored by a task force Garber convened on Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian bias. The two groups jointly collected 2,300 responses to a campus climate survey, with the anti-Semitism task force holding listening sessions with about 500 Jews on Harvard's campus. The detailed reports arrive as the Ivy League school is locked in a fierce battle with the White House, which has pulled billions of dollars in federal funding to the university, citing its failure to manage anti-Semitism. In response, Harvard sued the administration, which has also threatened to revoke the school's tax-exempt status. The school delayed the report's release amid the sparring, according to The Crimson, the student newspaper at Harvard. Task Force co-chair Derek Penslar, director of Harvard's Jewish Studies program and a past guest of Two Jewish, declined to comment on the delays. Alan Garber praised both reports' release in an accompanying letter to the campus community, which he promised to establish a research project on anti-Semitism and to support a comprehensive historical analysis of Muslim, Arabs, and Palestinians at Harvard. He pledged to review school disciplinary policies and find new ways to promote viewpoint diversity. The Anti-Semitism and Anti-Israel Task Force report paints a sobering portrait of the Harvard campus climate for Jewish and Israeli students. No other group was constantly told their history was a sham, that they or their co-religionists or co-ethnics were supremacists and oppressors, and that they had no right to the protections offered by anti-bias norms, reads one section. Many Jewish students told us they feel like objects of suspicion. A section of the report is devoted to the failures of staff and faculty at different Harvard schools to foster a welcoming environment for Jewish and Israeli students, including criticism of politicized instruction that mainstreamed and normalized what many Jewish and Israeli students experience as anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias. We urge the university and the schools to take on the mantle of moral leadership in the fight against anti-Semitism and anti-Israel bias. We are deeply concerned these forms of bigotry are becoming increasingly normalized in academia. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Richard Kreitner is an author. His new book is called Fear No Pharaoh, American Jews, the Civil War and the Fight to End Slavery. He's also the author of Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union, and booked A Traveler's Guide to Literary Locations Around the World. By the way, that first book seems like a great excuse to go travel.
It is. I mean, you can travel from the comfort of your own armchair, however, and you know, read about Dickens's London and everybody else's travels all over the world.
And everybody else is Paris, actually. Coming back to the question of the deep challenge that slavery poses and how much it has shaped the American experience, Jews were not the largest part of that by any stretch. Tell us a little bit about how that played out.
No, certainly not. You know, Jews were neither disproportionately involved in slavery, nor were we, as I think we would often like to imagine ourselves, you know, somehow immune to what was going on at the time. We were here. We were, you know, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, accepted as white in the early years of the Republic, and then I think through the Civil War. And that required a certain kind of going along with the practices and laws of the land, as the Torah has it. So, you know, if you're a Jewish person and you arrive in Mobile, Alabama in 1840 and you start to, you know, climb the ladder of success, you're going to have a hard time making it by not either participating in the slave economy or at least keeping your mouth shut if you have any qualms about it. You know, it'd be a very dangerous situation for vulnerable, you know, foreign-born population to put its neck out there by commenting on this system that, especially in the South, but also, you know, to some extent in the North, was accepted as the law of the land and guaranteed by the Constitution. So, you know, Jews were slave owners. Jews were slave traders before that, while it was still legal. They were involved in the legal, you know, enforcement of the institution and you know, and on the business side as well. You know, there's a story in my book, you know, some of us will know it from the Lehman trilogy, about the Lehman brothers arriving in Alabama and, you know, fairly quickly getting involved. They opened a store, but fairly quickly getting involved in accepting enslaved people as collateral for loans. And that's the beginning of the Lehman brothers banking operation. So, you know, we were, to the extent that we were here, we were as involved and as tainted by slavery as anybody else in the country at that time.
There were some Jewish abolitionists, but the abolition movement was really particularly Christian motivated, maybe is the best way to put it. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, abolitionism starts to rise in about the 1830s, which is the same period as the Second Great Awakening, which is a very large-scale revival in the religious life, overwhelmingly the Christian life, in the United States. Leaders of the movement, William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, these are very fervently Christian men. And while they often drew on the Old Testament and especially on the prophets to denounce oppression and call for justice, they really didn't often have very kind words to say about modern day Jews. Whenever an opponent was pro-slavery and they were Jewish, Garrison, in his, you know, influential newspaper, The Liberator, would go out of his way to point it out. There's one abolitionist who is Jewish who he knew, a woman named Ernestine Rose, who was born in Poland, moved to London, adopted a form of socialism, and then moved to the United States in 1836 and immediately started denouncing slavery, women's subjugation, more than a decade before the Seneca Falls Convention kickstarted the women's rights movement, and also organized religion. She was, you know, she held herself quite aloof from her Jewish origins, even though her opponents would never really let her forget them. And she was known to Garrison. She was friends with him. But for the most part, the movement, I think most Jews would have found it a fairly uncongenial place for them to be. A lot of the people who were involved in abolitionism were also involved in efforts to convert the Jews, or later on, you know, closer to the Civil War period, an effort to actually pass an amendment to the Constitution to officially make the United States a Christian nation. And, you know, understandably, Jews had very little interest in participating in such a movement.
There is a famous sermon, and you mentioned it early in your book, delivered by Rabbi Morris Jacob Rafal at B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue in New York, in which he basically says, well, the South is right about slavery, and we shouldn't be trying to restrict the practice that exists in the Bible. And then Rabbi David Einhorn speaks strongly against that, and there is a certain tension within the Jewish world as to how to respond, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just this incredibly rich debate. And as you say, this is known to history. You know, you'll find a paragraph about that debate, that moment in most, you know, surveys of American Jewish history. But what I really wanted to do with the whole book is just kind of blow that up as much as I could. Who was Rafal? Who was Einhorn, the anti-slavery rabbi in Baltimore, which is a slave city, who denounces Rafal's sermon and condemns anybody who says that Judaism is on the side of slavery? Isaac Mayer Wise was part of that debate. And I just wanted to kind of breathe as much life into this as I could, and then set it against the background of the larger American Jewish community's struggle to kind of come to terms with the political crisis over slavery and then the Civil War. I think Rafal was doing some interesting things there, actually. He does step in and he says that the Bible does endorse slavery, that the patriarchs own slaves, that it's blasphemy, really, for the abolitionists to say that God opposes slavery. So in there, he's intervening on the side of the South, and he had a lot of Southern friends, and he had a lot of congregants who were wealthy New Yorkers who had close business ties to the South and did not want a civil war. But he also says that Southern slavery, as it was practiced, was not in line with the biblical restrictions in which slaves do need to be treated with some kind of respect, and the slaves do have rights, as he says. So I kind of see his sermon as a attempt to really heal the breach. You know, he's delivered in January of 1861, just a week or two after South Carolina has seceded from the Union. He's basically trying to heal the breach between North and South, fuse the country back together, and as I say in the book, use Judaism as the glue, which seems like such an improbable kind of quixotic exercise. And of course, it did not work. But I think that's how he saw his intervention. He also, was engaged in a very vigorous debate at this time with the early proponents of Reform Judaism in the United States, who were arguing that the Bible was a document from an earlier time and that it was okay to kind of shear away those elements that no longer spoke to the concerns of the present. And I think taking a kind of biblical literalist view and saying that slavery is in the Bible, therefore the Bible is okay with slavery, was also a way of intervening in this religious debate that Jews were having at that time about to what extent you could reinterpret the Torah to account for changes that had happened and to account for changing needs of modern times.
There are deep contradictions in not only the way that America responded, but the way sometimes Jews were treated or individual Jews responded. Ulysses Grant had Jewish friends before the Civil War and tried to appoint a Jew to the first cabinet position when he became president, but he's the only, to this date, United States representative who ever promulgated an anti-Jewish edict. Let's talk about that, number 10. Sorry, order number 11.
Which is issued, this is just absolutely fascinating, it's issued at the end of December of 1862. And what he's really livid about is that as the Union, there's a Union blockade against the South. So the South was not able to ship its cotton to Europe, which would have given it more money to, be able to fund the war. But as the Union took more territory from the South, there were calls to allow cotton from those areas to get out to the world in order to, get planters onto the Union side. But there was a lot of illegal trade going on at the time, and some Jews were involved, though not to the extent that Grant and other people said that they were. Some people blamed the trade on the Jews, even though they themselves were involved in trying to profit off this illicit cotton trade. And so Grant, he's fed up by the end of December of 1862. The precipitating moment is his father actually arrives, his kind of shiftless father, Jesse, arrives in Grant's camp in Mississippi, along with a Jewish manufacturer from Cincinnati, and they've got a scheme to kind of smuggle some cotton out of the South in order to make money. And it was actually the cotton was needed for Union Army uniforms. But in any case, so Grant throws his father out. He says he's not going to be part of such a deal. And he actually issues this order banning all Jews from his military district, which had never happened in America before. It has not happened since. The Confederates never tried anything of the kind. It's really a rash overstepping of the Constitution. And so his soldiers start to put into effect. A few families are kicked out of Paducah, Kentucky, and some other places. But it seems that the order was kind of slow-walked, and the enforcement was not as thorough as it might have been. Eventually, a delegation of concerned Jews arrives in Washington, D.C., where they meet with Lincoln, who immediately overturns the order. So the story has often been told as a fairly triumphalist one, in which American Jews organized politically to seek a redress of grievances. Lincoln was responsive, and it's a good story. I think if you actually look at it, it was a fairly traumatic episode for a lot of American Jews, and I think it made them question their place in the United States and led to a type of insecurity that lasted long after the war ended. And the other elements about it that I think has been kind of insufficiently emphasized in the past is, as I say, the order is issued in late December of 1862, rescinded by Lincoln just 2 weeks later, January 4th, I want to say, of 1863. What happens in the meantime, on January 1st, New Year's Day, famously, is the Emancipation Proclamation is issued, you know, banning the beginning of the abolition of slavery in the United States. And some newspapers, those two documents, Grant's anti-Semitic order banning Jews from his military district and Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freeing enslaved people in the Confederate states that were in rebellion, were printed side by side in the newspaper, causing some Jews to see a kind of zero-sum competition, really, between African Americans and Jews, such that, you know, one group was rising as the other's fortunes seemed to be falling in the United States. And I think that that led to a very kind of grim understanding of where Jews sit in the post-war country.
I want to talk a little bit about maybe the most controversial and probably the most prominent Jew in America in the Civil War period, Judah P. Benjamin. Some facts came out in your book. I didn't realize his father had been one of the organizers at KK Beth Elohim, who had led that congregation from being a Sephardic Orthodox congregation to becoming a German Reform congregation, or that he had been thrown out for refusing to close his store on Shabbat. Tell us a little bit about Judah P. Benjamin.
Yeah, he's absolutely fascinating. I mean, on the one hand, he's the most well-known of my six, you know, characters or major figures that I'm focusing on. And on the other is he's one of the most elusive. He burned his papers twice, you know, specifically because he explicitly said that he didn't want any biography of him to ever be written. Born in the Caribbean, making him a British subject from birth, which ends up being quite important for his story later on. He's raised in Charleston, where his family moves when he's 10 years old. The Denmark-VC Rebellion happens right around the time that they get there, and the bodies of the accused rebels are probably visible from the top floor of the Benjamin's house. So he's growing up really in this crucible of American slavery. He goes to Yale University, where he is only the second Jewish student ever to attend.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing. They hadn't had a Jewish student in 20 years. They'd only had one before Judah P. Benjamin.
And he leaves Yale under kind of odd circumstances. It might have had something to do with gambling or some other form of ungentlemanly conduct, as they said at the time. He finds his way to New Orleans, where he's actually able to kind of get a footing and start to rise in a way that in Charleston, with this kind of hidebound planter elite, would not really have been possible. But New Orleans, because of the mixture of cultures and languages and religions and races, it's possible for Benjamin to rise quite rapidly as a lawyer. He marries a woman. They have a very strange marriage. They have one child. The wife almost immediately leaves for Paris with their daughter, and the two don't really live together again for, I want to say, 30 years.
Wow.
Quite possible that Judah Benjamin was gay. This is something that biographers are only beginning to consider now. They could have hinted at in the past, but I think didn't really quite have the language to talk about. But I think there's pretty good circumstantial evidence that's the case. Certainly that was gossiped about at the time by his enemies. He is elected a senator from Louisiana. Well, first of all, he buys a plantation with about 140 enslaved people on it. I think partly...
By the way, that's a lot of slaves for that period. That's a big plantation.
He's very involved in the plantation's management. I think he basically buys the plantation. You know, he's a city lawyer. What does he want with a sugar plantation? It seems to me like he's very openly trying to kind of ingratiate himself with the state's planter elite. It works. They elect him to the Senate. One account specifically says because he understood the interests of his fellow plantation owners. No sooner is he elected to the Senate than he sells off that plantation, I think confirming my hypothesis that that's the only reason he bought it. And then in the 1850s, he's one of the leading spokesmen for states' rights and for the pro-slavery position in the United States Senate. One of the most eloquent speechmakers that has ever been in the Senate. He has this just incredibly beautiful, silvery voice.
Dulcet tones, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I would love to, you know, be able to sit in on him gambling and drinking and quoting Shakespeare in that wonderful voice. My editor said towards the end of my work on the book that it seemed like I liked Benjamin the most of all my characters. But definitely I despise his politics and his embrace of slavery, but I did come to admire him as a person. He has this incredible drive and ambition and a real stoicism to him. Any setback that he endures in life, which are several and intense, including the end of the Confederacy when he's the only leading statesman to escape to not get arrested by federal troops.
Right.
He survived something like three shipwrecks in getting himself to England.
Incredible story, right.
Where he has his whole second career as a very major barrister.
A super important barrister who writes some of the seminal text on common law, actually.
That England. Are still being studied. I mean, this is an amazing character. There really ought to be a movie about him.
It would be quite a movie. Richard, I feel like we could go on for hours. The book is called Fear No Pharaoh. Where can people find out more about you and about the book?
Sure. I have a website, richardkreitner.com. I just started a podcast, actually, I should mention, called Think Back, in which I'm interviewing U.S. historians about connections between the past and the present. And the book should be everywhere. Amazon, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, best of all your local bookstores.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll have a final musical play out and hear about next week's guest.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week, another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Dr. Jesse Gold, author of How Do You Feel? One Doctor's Search for Humanity in Medicine. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from this year's Israel entry in Eurovision. It's called A New Day Will Rise, sung by Yuval Raphael in English, French, and a little Hebrew. My friends, have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
And even if you say goodbye, you'll never go away. You are the rainbow in my sky, my colors in the gray, my only wish upon a star, sunshine of the day. The only song that my piano ever plays. And even if you say goodbye, you're always.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
My feet close to the ground, are you proud of me tonight? Dreams are coming true. I choose the light, nothing to lose if I lose you. New day will rise, life will go on. Everyone cries, don't cry alone. Darkness will fade, all the pain will go by. But we will stay, even if you say goodbye. Et même si tu dis adieu, tu ne partiras jamais. Mon conciel dans mon ciel bleu. Mes colères dans le cri, mon seul souhait sous un ciel tard. Un rayon de ma journée. La seule chanson que mon piano peut jouer. My life.
מים רבים לא יחבו את האהבה ונהרות לא ישטפו Even if you say goodbye, new day.